We'll get underway. We met in, let me get my agenda here. We met in closed session and we discussed real property. We discussed and conference with labor negotiations, labor negotiators. Is there a consensus on the order of business? Everyone good? Okay, thank you. We have some minutes from the study session of October 16th that need to be approved. Any comments, remarks, revisions? Okay. And a motion to approve those would be appreciated.
I'll move approval.
Go.
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Oh, that's right. Mrs. Roger?
I need to abstain from that, please.
Okay. All in favor of accepting those minutes?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, we've got, okay. Mr. Buckman will be back. So we have four yeses, an abstention, and Mr. Millar is not here this evening. Then we have approval for our regular board meeting on October 20th. Any changes, revisions? Okay. Could we have a motion, please, for those?
Of the minutes of the 20th.
Okay. And a second?
I'll second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And then we have?
An abstention due to technical difficulties.
That's right. And are you abstaining from October 20th?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh. Yes.
Marilyn? Okay. Are you good, Kim? Okay. Now, our favorite part of the evening, student representatives of the board. Did you guys flip a coin down there? Who's going to go first?
Hello. My name is Bella Stenvall. I'm the representative for San Luis Obispo High School. So as a lot of the board members know, probably last week we were doing a whole lot of fundraising for our favorite lunch lady on campus, Greta Schultz. Ms. Holmes was nice enough to send out a really nice flyer about that to all you guys. So we set up a GoFundMe account, which has right now about $6,500 in it, I believe. We also hosted our Powder Puff Games, which are our female football games that we do every year, and all the ticket sales, all the proceeds from that also went to Greta, which was about $2,000. So that, along with our Miracle Minute, which we had at school, which raised $2,500, we have a total of about $12,000 that we're going to be able to give to Greta for her medical bills, which is amazing. And it was a really awesome week to see our school and our community really get together to support this woman who has made a huge impact on every single one of us individually, just from going to the cafeteria in order to get a snack maybe once a day. So that was very special. And Greta actually came out during halftime at our games and said a little thank you. And it was pretty emotional, but very, very cool to see. Also, three of our current SLO High students and four alumni this week went to Louisville, Kentucky for the 88th National FFA Convention for Advanced Parliamentary Procedure. And they won nationals, which is a huge deal. So they came back with the national trophy for advanced parliamentary procedure, and we are amazed and very, very proud of that team because they've been working for the past year to try to get that national award. So that was very, very exciting for us. Also, we have a canned food drive right now, which is a class competition, which gets very intense because the sophomores and seniors are very close in class competition points for that $1,000 at the end of the year. And we are also gearing up for our winter sports, so we have practices starting for that. And yes, that's all I have for today.
Hi, my name is, can you guys hear me? Yeah, okay. Hi, my name is Riley, and I'm the representative for Morro Bay High School. This last week, our principal, Dr. Pruitt, and some other teachers went down south to spend some time at High Tech High in Southern California, and they learned about project-based learning, and they're all really excited to keep learning about it and try and see how they can incorporate project-based learning in our school and our science classes, and we're going to try and incorporate making projects with bees, fish, and chicken brooders. Last Friday, the day before Halloween, we had a costume contest with three different categories. The first category was the most original and creative costume. The second category was the scariest costume, and the third category was the best group costume. Each of the categories would receive a box, or each winner of the categories received would receive a box of a dozen donuts to share with their friends. And then third, the girls cross country finish league tomorrow, and their finals are taking place in Cabrillo. The girls are pretty confident. They're first in league right now, and they're hoping that they'll do well tomorrow and beat Templeton. Also, girls water polo is starting soon, and they're excited to have a brand new coach coaching them this year, Coach Silva, and he's also an active coach in coaching the women's national water polo team. And then last week, Morro Bay surf team gained public recognition with an interview with KSBY6. We're talking about how we're working on trying to get insurance for the surf team to make it associated and affiliated with a school. Also, ASB is voting on whether or not to have a mock rock this year. We haven't had a great turnout and had too many participants do it in previous years, so we're just trying to go all out this year. Boys water polo is finishing up their season. They're led by Coach John, and it looks like we're going to go to CIF. They have one more game to determine whether they're going to do that or not. Thank you, guys.
Well, thank you both. You each have a lot going on. We appreciate you taking the time to be with us this evening. As usual, you're welcome to stay, but if you need to get home and take care of business, school-related business, of course, feel free to leave us now or at any time throughout the meeting. Thank you so much. Thanks a lot. Okay, at this time, we're going to be having our personnel commission interviews.
So I would like to invite Julie and David to come up here to the hot seats. And I just really want to thank these two individuals for considering serving on our personnel commission. It is a volunteer position, meets weekly, much like the board members, as you know. And it's a lot of time commitment, and we do appreciate the fact that these two members who live in San Luis coastal boundaries and who are registered voters are interested in serving on our district in this way. And before we start with the interviews, I'd like to thank Gail Sears, one of our personnel commissioners, for coming here tonight also. So this process must be done in public, and so we're going to be having the board president, Ellen Sheffer, will be running the interviews and basically alternating asking four questions, so alternating each one of the candidates with a question to start, and then the other candidate will answer that same question, and then that other person will have the first opportunity to answer the next question. At the end of the four questions, the board will deliberate in public. The board will select somebody that they will be appointing, but the appointment will not come until 30 days from now, because the public has an opportunity to be able to speak to the candidate that you are recommending forward. And so the actual appointment will come on the December 15th board agenda. So at this point in time, I will turn it over to our board president, right, Ellen Sheffer.
Thank you very much for your interest in this important position. We very much appreciate it. I will do my best to make sure that I am logistically correct here. So with that, we'll get started. Mrs. Roger is going to ask Mrs. Jones the first question, and then Mr. Wehner, you'll have a chance to have the question repeated before you need to respond.
Okay. Mrs. Jones, if you are appointed personnel commissioner,
You will be applying complex provisions of the Education Code in order to assure that procedures are carried out correctly. What rules, regulations, or company policies have you had occasion to work with, review, or apply?
Well, I work for San Luis Coastal as a counselor, and in my position as a counselor, I communicated a lot with staff, and we had to go over the rules and the regulations for different appointments. I sat on interview panels for those. I also currently serve on the Human Relations Commission for the City of San Luis, and our mandate there is to distribute funding through three different kinds of grants to nonprofits, which have some very strict guidelines for us to follow. And so I've had the opportunity to study those guidelines, work with those nonprofits, and make sure that we are on course and doing the things that are proper.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Quessenberry, would you restate the question for
Mr.
Wynn?
Yes, it's not necessary.
We might need to do it for the record, just to make sure that we're all clear.
Okay.
Just to be on the up and up here. Totally. Okay. If you are appointed personnel commissioner, you will be applying complex provisions of the Education Code in order to assure that procedures are carried out correctly. What rules, regulations, or company policies have you had an occasion to work with, review, or apply?
Well, basically, my experience has been as dean of the College of Agriculture at Cal Poly, mm-hmm. which is a unionized environment. We had two unions, predominant unions, Unit 3, which was the faculty, and Unit 4, which was the staff. And I had a personnel analyst that did a lot of the paperwork, but I was familiar with a lot of the rules and regulations that apply to the faculty or the staff. There were other units, some of the mechanics and things were in Unit 6, but predominantly Unit 3 and Unit 4. And as dean, I was basically the chief personnel officer for the college, the only person that can hire, terminate, or discipline someone in that college was the dean. So I've had extensive experience with those rules and regulations and union agreements, collective bargaining agreements based on what the CSU set up as a system, and then we would work with the local, well, we would work with the HR department at the university level when we had a question or a hire that we had to place into the system. And then again, I had a personnel analyst that did a lot of the paperwork, and I had signature authority on all the decisions that were made.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Buckman, if you would ask Mr. Winner, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. If you would ask Mr. Winner this question too.
Sure. Could you describe any similar experience you've had, have had serving in public or community service roles, and has any of this experience required you to serve on any appeals boards?
Well, I've been on a couple boards. One was the state board on agriculture, which I was appointed by Governor Schwarzenegger at the time. There was a space there for a CSU representative. And then I served on a national group, which was a advisory committee to the United States Department of Agriculture. In both those situations, we had technically, in the state level, we had technically authority to do a lot of punitive actions or investigations and so on, but typically it was just an advisory committee to the governor. And on the national one, we just reviewed what the USDA did. So I guess not exactly what you're talking about, but I've had experience with some national and state level boards. The dean position at Cal Poly, especially for the College of Agriculture, because of the extensive nature of the holdings and all the things going on, really didn't allow me too much time to do things outside the university.
Thank you. And Ms. Eisendrath Rogers, if you would restate it for Ms. Jones.
Ms. Jones, same question. Describe any similar experience you have had serving in public or community service roles. Has any of this experience required you to serve on an appeals board?
I've volunteered on several different boards, although none really as an appeals, I must say. I serve as a commissioner on the status of women for the County of San Luis Obispo, and our mandate is to research the needs of women and children, families in this area, and send recommendations to the County Board of Supervisors as to the needs in our county. We go before the board and each year and make this report and ask for their financial support. I think that's an appeal when you're appealing to the County Board of Supervisors at all, but not in the way you're talking. I have worked with an organization called WomenAid, which we fund immediate needs for people in the community. And as a board, we have to make decisions as to what is appropriate and what isn't. And we have had some people come back and appeal those decisions.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Unger, if you would ask Ms. Jones question 3.
Sure. There's sometimes a difficult balancing act between considering fairly the interests of employees and employee groups with the fiscal and policy interests of the Board of Education. How would you manage that balancing act?
Well, in reading some material, things are pretty much mapped out as far as the requirements and rules and regulations that it's not something that you can be very capricious on. You have to follow the rules, make sure there's equity on both sides and fairness on both sides. And I think I've had experience in that as a school counselor. I spent a lot of time being the kind of the negotiator in the middle of a lot of different situations. Sometimes it's parents and students. Sometimes it's teachers and students and teachers and parents. And so I spent many years having to look at all sides of a problem and be the person, that kind of calm negotiator that can bring a positive outcome to a situation.
Thank you. And Mrs. Roger?
Mr. Wehner, there is sometimes a difficult balancing act between considering fairly the interests of employees and employee groups with the fiscal and policy interests of the Board of Education. How would you manage that balancing act?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to look out for the best interest of the organization if you're in a position of leadership. But I think what you do is, when you're making decisions, if you follow three basic policies, and first of all is total integrity. The second thing is common sense. A lot of times we get into trouble in some of these kinds of situations because someone isn't using common sense. And the third thing is consistency. And when I was involved as the dean, I would really hope that as people came to ask me about situations, that they had a good idea how I was going to react, because I was trying to be consistent with those situations. One of the problems in California and in the United States is everyone thinks they're working harder than everyone else. I mean, if you talk to a faculty or an employee or anyone, they feel like they're the most important person in the organization. And you have to kind of balance that. You want to promote merit-type activities, but you also have to be careful that you don't set up situations where you're not being consistent and you're not following the rules. As the previous speaker mentioned, there is a set of rules. There's negotiations, there's bargaining agreements, and so on. But you just have to be careful. And if you develop a reputation like that, I think you minimize the problems that you might have in the future with a faculty or a staff person in this situation coming forward and expecting something that they should really know isn't possible. You can't play favorites. You've got to really evaluate the situation. If there is a mechanism for merit raises, in our situation at Cal Poly, there was a in-range progression that was available for staff. And that was one way we could reward really hardworking staff, but we still had to be careful that we didn't make it inequitable and treat someone unfairly or with favoritism.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Quessenberry, question four to Mr. Wehner, please. Okay.
It is sometimes necessary to render a decision which is unpopular. How would you manage delivering an unpopular decision to people who will likely disagree with the commission's decision?
Well, I think it sort of goes back to my previous answer about developing a track record where everybody understands that there is a given set of rules, that they're being fairly applied to every individual and every group. And so when they come to see you, they should have an idea of what's going to happen, what's going to be a reasonable solution or decision. No matter what you do, people are going to be unhappy with you. The example I would give is, let's say I made a decision for a faculty member that faculty member disagreed with, but the other 100 faculty members agreed with. The next time I made another decision for another faculty member that faculty member disagreed with, but the other 100 faculty agreed with, you start to develop a group of people that aren't happy with you, but you have to have that consistency in your decisions. And again, people come in and should expect the answer if they're asking for something that's way off base or doesn't follow some general guidelines that have been established from past history.
Thank you.
Mr. Buckman.
It is sometimes necessary to render a decision which is unpopular. How would you manage delivering an unpopular decision to people who will likely disagree with the commission's decision?
I think it's important to have to back up what you say. When you're giving a decision, to be able to explain clearly and in such a way, in such a manner that is very clear to the person that you're delivering it to, that it's not a personal decision, but it's based on, and then be really definite on what you're basing your decision on and the rules and the procedures that back that decision up. It's always important, I think, that you, when you work with people, to be positive with them, even in a negative situation. And I think you can do that. I think you can let them know the things you appreciate about their position and the things that they've said, and yet give them the straight answer and let them know why.
Thank you. That concludes the questions we have. Does anyone have any clarifying questions for the candidates? Otherwise, we can begin our deliberations. Yes?
I have just one question. It's not about the questions we just asked, though. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I see from your resumes that you're each very involved in the community and other organizations, and it's tremendously admirable. I'm just wondering, in terms of a time commitment, what your expectation is of the time commitment of serving this particular position.
No, go ahead.
I retired from Cal Poly July 1st of 2014, so I have a lot of time. In fact, that's why I'm sitting here, because I'm starting to look at ways that I might be of service to the community. I was just appointed to the personnel board for the city of San Luis, which sounds sort of interesting, but in fact they haven't met for several years because there's not been any employee disputes or problems, which they asked me about going to meetings. I said, no, it doesn't bother me that this group has not met, but I have quite a bit of time. It's not a problem for me.
Thank you.
And I'm also retired from San Luis Coastal. 2012, my husband and I took a year off and went to Africa and served there. When I came back, I made a very conscious decision that this was a season for me to get involved in my community, because I'd been really busy involved in raising children and working and all those things before that. And so that's my season for this, and I am involved in lots of different things. I'm having a wonderful time. It brings me great joy. And I've looked at the schedule. It doesn't really seem to be a problem. Most of the activities I'm in meet once a month. This meets once a month, plus some other times. I'm told I don't see a problem at all.
Thank you. Any other questions from the board? All right. So we're ready to deliberate, and this is as uncomfortable in some ways for us as it is for you.
Can we leave?
No. I will say I was in that seat at one time, and I survived, so here we go. So does anyone have any feedback at this time or discussion?
I'll start. What the heck?
Thanks, Chris.
Well, I have to thank both of you. You're just, the fact that you're willing to stand up and serve our district is commendable and admirable, and you've heard all those things before. The Personnel Commission, as you know, is a tremendously important part of the school district. It is independent from the school board, although you do things for the organization. We set the overall policies. But whoever is chosen will be really our representative, but really an equal third member of a great organization, I think. And I think that's fair to say, who really makes a tremendous difference to our classified employees. And I think several of us have really strong feelings about the treatment that our classified employees should be getting. We really feel strongly that it's important to treat our classified employees fairly. I could almost toss a coin and be happy with both of you. I see both of you having strengths in different areas, but I don't get to do that. I'm going to support you, Julie, and I'll tell you why. You have been part of San Luis Coastal for a long time, and I admire your willingness to come back and take on a different role in the organization, a role that I think it's going to be different for you. Mr. Weiner, or Dr. Weiner, you have a tremendous amount of experience as well. Your experience is different. You both have been involved in the community. You've both been involved in a lot of things. Julie, I know you've been involved in Women Aid and the Commission on Women, and you've given to that. Sir, you are going to be working with the Personnel Commission for the city. Julia, I'm going to support you, again, I think because of your ongoing commitment, your longtime commitment to the district.
Any other comments? Any other discussion?
Then I'm going to...
Go ahead.
I'm going to make a motion that we support Julie Jones for the Personnel Commissioner, representing the board.
All right. Dr. Eisendrath Rogers, did you?
Well, I was just going to say regarding Dr. Weiner that I feel like he represents a balanced approach between staff and personnel. So in terms of the numbers, they come up extremely close. So that's a tough decision, but I appreciated that you brought that up, what you were feeling about that, Chris. And I do understand with Ms. Jones' history, and I just wonder if that's a plus or a minus. So I'm on the fence about that one, and I slightly leaned in terms of numbers toward Dr. Weiner.
Any further discussion? We have a motion. We don't have a second. Would anyone like to second the motion that's on the floor? All right. This will die for lack of a second. Any additional discussion at this time? Mr. Buckman.
I'm going to pick up Chris's coin and wish I could flip it as well. What I heard was a great deal of commitment. I heard Julie, you talk about the research you did for this interview and looking into the Personnel Commission. And Dr. Weiner, the experience is just phenomenal. And so I have to say I'm still sitting on the fence on this, and it's going to be difficult for me. So, but I also want to just thank you for what you're doing.
Okay. Well, to be clear, we do have a decision in front of us that we need to make this evening. So there's only so much fence sitting that we can do here this evening, difficult though it may be. Mrs. Roger.
Well, it is hard. I mean, we're sincere when we say I think that you're both really good candidates, and it's hard to make a choice. As other people have said, you're both involved and have been involved in numerous community activities. I think my sense was that Ms. Jones would be a kind of a kinder, gentler approach, and Mr. Weiner would be, and Dr. Weiner would be more of a cut and dried, you know, approach. Both of which are good approaches. I don't know, not having sat on the Personnel Commission, I don't know which one is better. As the board's rep to a group that has to work well, to a group of three that has to work well together, can't be too didactic, but have to be able to be decisive. I'm going to move Ms. Jones again and see if I can get a second for it.
I'll second that.
We have a motion and a second. Do we have any further discussion? Mr. Buckman, you look like your hand was headed towards your microphone. Do you have any further discussion? Mr. Quisenberry.
Well, my sense of the Personnel Commission is that it's sort of a cut and dry, that they follow the policies. And I'm just going to make that comment and suggest that Dr. Weiner be our nominee.
Is that all right? Okay, we're going to – I need someone from parliamentary group who won. We have a motion and a second. So then,
motion died for lack of second.
No, Chris seconded it.
Oh, you did. Okay.
So, and then we had further discussion, and Mr. Quisenberry would like to put forth Dr. Weiner, that's part of the discussion. So I suppose we need to vote on the first motion. I see nods. I'm getting good support over there. Is there further discussion?
Oh, yeah. Of course. Sorry.
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Quisenberry. Yes, I had the sense of what we're all seeing here, and I do believe Ms. Jones would be a warm and friendly face on that committee, and I can understand the comfort level of the person who is making that appeal. But I do think that it is in our best interest to have someone with the experience of making those clear and tough decisions. And I think the reason my numbers came out higher for Mr. Weiner, Dr. Weiner, is that he does have the track record of making those tough decisions, in my opinion.
Any further discussion? Right. We will vote on the motion and the second as proposed by Marilyn and seconded by Chris for Ms. Jones. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Okay. And I will vote aye. So we have a all opposed.
Can I have a show of hands? It's hard to tell from your
for
voices.
For the eyes?
Voting. Eyes? Okay, so we have four.
So, and then two opposed. So that correct? Okay. All right. As you can see, this was a challenging and thought-out decision for us, hopefully. So, Ms. Jones, welcome. Dr. Wehner, thank you again for your interest. At this time, the board has concluded its interview process and deliberations for personnel commissioner. We have taken our vote. Congratulations, Ms. Jones. We would like to thank both of you sincerely for your interest in serving. I have a few more little sentences I have to say here. The law under Education Code 45246 requires that the board publicly announce the person it intends to appoint, and then we'll hold a public hearing 30 to 45 days from today in order for the public to have an opportunity to comment on the appointment. Therefore, the formal appointment will occur at our regularly scheduled board meeting on Tuesday, December 15th. But thank you so much for your interest and for taking the time. I know this is a process. So thanks and congratulations, Ms. Jones. Thank you, Dr. Wehner. Okay. At this time, we will move on to correspondence. I believe there was none. So we'll go on to public comment. This is the time for members of the public to come forward and speak should they wish to address something not on the agenda or that they may not want to wait for on the agenda. All right. Seeing no one, we will move on to superintendent's updates. Business and budget update first.
So something crazy happened this week. It rained.
It did.
It was really nice to have a little rainfall. But just so the board knows, our BG&T team, Anthony Plazo, Steve Stewart, and all of the BG&T staff have really been preparing kind of for an El Nino and talking about, you know, clearing the gutters, getting things set, looking for leaks, just getting out there. One of the things that kind of happened last year, just so the board knows, is when we redid all of our safety plans and we're looking through that, is then that led us to making sure that everybody knew where the shutoffs were, which has then led us to the old tubs at all of the school sites, which were really big trash cans full of emergency supplies and those types of things. And so we have been basically a process of starting over from the emergency tubs that we had at our school sites that have been there since probably early 1990s. So it's been really good. Been fantastic. So those are going to be going out to site soon. In Friday notes, I'll give you some more information about kind of the changes and some of the old artifacts that we found in some of the old tubs, and you know, some of the new thinking about emergency preparedness and safety. But I bring it up just because it's something that it never ends. You know, thinking about safety plans, those types of things, is something we constantly need to be focused on and dealing with on a constant basis. And then lastly, I just wanted to share with the board, we are expecting kind of our prospective property taxes for the 15-16 school year should be coming, hopefully from the County Office of Education mid-month.
Thank you. And then before Mr. Robinette, I just wanted to recognize a guest we have in the audience tonight and then send her on her way should she wish to. But we have a proud graduate of San Luis Obispo High School here. Jane Sheffer, so thank you for attending briefly, however long you wish to stay. You, as our high school representatives, have homework. Should you wish to attend to that, you may leave at any time or feel free to stay for as long as you wish. Thank you for coming by. Mr. Robinette.
Well, speaking of San Luis Obispo High School, I just wanted to reiterate a little bit about what Bella said. We had our FFA students come back from Louisville on Sunday, and it's really amazing. The kids from SLO High that qualified for the national convention really returned with an unprecedented award. The FFA has been in existence since 1928, and our novice Parley Pro team that won year or two ago. Many of those members went on now to win the Advanced Parliamentary Procedure Award. One of our students, Amber Bajir, has now won 3 national championships. Wow. It's never been accomplished in FFA history. Wow. SLO High School has the national secretary, Mara Basich-Peace, who happens to be attending Cornell right now. The outstanding national member for FFA is from San Luis Obispo High School, Charlie Tieford. And, of course, the state of California has the FFA president from San Luis Obispo High School serving her year after high school, Joelle Lewis. So we'll have to arrange to have these kids come talk to the board at some point because we're talking about 50 states, the Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, 7,700 individual chapters, 600,000-plus FFA members, and once again, San Luis Obispo High School here in Little San Luis Obispo taking multiple national honors. So kudos to those kids and their teachers, Anna Bates and Jody Evans, for all the work they do with them. So that's all I have. I'm just so proud of those kids.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, thank you. And it would be wonderful to invite them to a meeting together with Ms. Bates and Ms. Evans. That would be great. Thank you. Measure D update, Mr. Holcomb. Are you providing that?
So just a couple.
Never know where to look.
Just a couple quick things because we have a lot of Measure D contracts to review tonight. Two things in particular, we'll be bringing the board very soon our pre-qualification bid documents for design, bid, build for some of our future projects, including the Morro Bay High School pool, which will hopefully be through DSA around January, February, so we can get started on that project. And then we'll also be erecting some signs at both Morro Bay High School as well as San Luis Obispo High School and some of our other schools should the projects tonight move forward so that we can kind of show the public where we're headed, what's happening, and kind of make sure that people understand that we are beginning construction very soon.
Thank you. Next, we have item 8.01, board's interest for negotiations with SLCTA.
I'll go ahead and take this one. This is just a public hearing that we have to have before we sunshine with our association. So this is a fairly broad base, but we will be beginning negotiations with the San Luis Coastal Teachers Association in early December, and this is an opportunity for public hearing.
Okay, we will now open this public hearing for the board's interest for negotiations with SLCTA. Is there any public testimony in this regard? Seeing none, we will now close the public hearing. Thank you. We will move on to our discussion items, 9.01, advanced placement data.
Good evening. I'm here with Neil Eckhart tonight to present to you our advanced placement AP data. So Neil will be going over data for Morro Bay High School and San Luis Obispo High School, drawing some conclusions per school as he goes along. And at the end, I'll be happy to come back up and to draw some overall conclusions about next steps and what we're finding. Just before Neil begins, I just wanted to bring forward one point you probably saw in your backup information about some of the subgroups we're looking at. We did decide to look at the same subgroups that we began to look at with our ESPEC data. So you will see that we did include our two largest ethnic subgroups beginning this year, and we'll begin to kind of start that pattern of the subgroups that we'll look at in our data will mirror what we've looked at in ESPEC. So now I hand it over to Neil.
Good evening, everybody. Glad to be back with you again this evening. I'm going to do an update tonight on our advanced placement data, and I'll be walking through results for both of our high schools. And I'll start with Morro Bay High School. I think I'll need to wait for a clicker here, perhaps. while I'm waiting for that, I'll kind of talk about, I'll go through a similar pattern with both schools. So I'll talk about the number of AP courses that are offered there, AP enrollments at each site, performance on AP exams, and then I'll also frame some possible conclusions. There we go. Okay, so these are currently the AP courses that are being offered at Morro Bay High now. These are similar courses to ones that you've seen in the past, with the exception that there are two courses that are not being offered this year, and that is AP Calculus BC is not being offered this year, as well as AP Art History. So those are similar to the ones that you've seen in the past, with the exception of those two. Okay. So enrollment in advanced placement courses at Morro Bay High School. So let me kind of try to walk us through this figure. So we have in blue, we have that's total students at the high school. In orange, we have our RFEP students. So just as a reminder, those are our students that have been reclassified as English proficient. They were initially English learners. And then we have our SED students. These are our students who are socioeconomically disadvantaged. And so in 2015-16, in total, 23% of students at Morro Bay High are enrolled in AP courses. And one thing I should point out that we changed this year, those percentages that you'll see and that you'll see for SLO High School are only for 10th through 12th grade. And so Kim and I decided actually to leave the 9th graders out because our 9th graders really don't enroll in AP courses. Like that process begins in 10th grade. And so we thought that was actually a more represent, that metric would be a more valuable metric. So in total, we do see some increase at Morro Bay High School, a 3% increase over the last 5 years. We see a 14% increase in enrollment for our RFEP students, and then for our SED students, a 5% increase over the last 5 years.
Mr. Quesenberry?
Do you think the increase in the RFEP students is due to AVID? Have you investigated that at all?
That is not something that we've investigated so far, but certainly something that we could, and I think a good suggestion. We actually already have it in the database, and we could cross-link the course alignment. I'd be happy to do that and to communicate the results of it.
I would second that, and Mr. Quisenberry, please stop stealing my questions. No, but it is an interest of mine as well.
Great suggestion. Thank you. Okay, so the next thing that we did is we wanted to look at our AP performance on AP exams, and we kind of asked ourselves two questions there. So we said, first of all, are students that are enrolled in AP classes, are they taking the AP exam? That was one question. And the second question was, of our students that do take the exam, how do they do? And so in blue there, you'll see those are the percentage of students that were enrolled in AP courses that actually took the exam. And then the black line on the graph is the percentage of exam scores that are 3 or better. And the reason why we focus on 3 or better is that's the number that makes our students eligible to receive college credit. And so we can see that, you know, just for last year, 71% of our enrolled students at Morro Bay High took the AP exams, and then 68% of those students who took the exam scored a 3 or better. And I think if we look at those data over the last 5 years, we see pretty consistent, steady measures there. Perhaps in the last year, a little bit of a decline in the percentage of enrolled students that were tested.
That's 71 of the 23% who took it, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Although those are slightly different numbers because the 23% is for this year, okay, and we don't have their test results yet. Correct. Okay, so to frame some possible conclusions, I won't go through every item here, but I'll just kind of try to summarize. We do see some increases in enrollment at Morro Bay High School when we talk about AP courses. However, most students at Morro Bay High School did not take an AP course, and you know currently 25% of them are taking one or two courses. to transition the conversation a little bit to San Luis Obispo High School. So currently, San Luis Obispo High School is offering 14 AP courses. This is similar list to lists that you've seen in the past, with the exception that one course is not being offered this year. That's AP Latin. But those are the same as previously besides that. So enrollment in AP courses at SLO High School, nearly half of SLO High School 10th through 12th graders are enrolled in an AP course. So 45% total. That's up 10% over the last 5 years. When we look at our RFEP students, 43% of them are enrolled in AP courses, up 11% over the last 5 years. And then when we look at our socioeconomically disadvantaged students, a 9% increase over the last 5 years. So it's similar, exact same framework that you saw for Morro Bay High School, this one for San Luis Obispo High School. When we look at performance on AP exams, when we look at the percentage of enrolled students that took the AP test, we see increases there over the last 5 years. So that's there, that's the black line there on the graph. And then simultaneously, when we see enrollments going up, we also see, although less of an increase, we do see increases in passing scores of 3 or better. So to frame some possible conclusions for San Luis Obispo High School, we're seeing increases in AP enrollments. And then this is perhaps best captured by, if we look at the senior class at San Luis Obispo High School right now, nearly two-thirds of them have taken at least one AP course. And then also tests taken and tests passed with a score of 3 or better have been increasing over the last 5 years.
Thank you.
So that's my part of the presentation. Thank you very much.
So overall, when we look at what conclusions we'd like to draw around AP, I mentioned the first one already. You'll see that there is a decrease in students taking Calculus BC, which is not a surprise since Common Core added an entire grade level at the eighth grade into our math sequence. So in order for students to reach Calculus BC, we'll take some advancement or some acceleration. So in order to reach Calculus BC would be... not likely, and would mean you were 2 or more years ahead in your math sequence. So this would is, you know, obviously not just for San Luis Coastal, what's happening nationally. We do feel like, I think that a big point to walk away from this is that we want to be more targeted. We need to be more strategic about not leaving AP enrollment up simply to student choice. There's obviously some student choice that needs to happen when it comes to AP enrollment. There needs to be a level of commitment there, but also to be more deliberate from staff members at the high schools about encouraging students that are showing that they are completely capable of performing well in an AP class, and to be more targeted and deliberate about that. So that's something that we've already started a conversation about, identifying those students using data and encouraging them to enroll in a class that may be challenging to them. The other thing that I think is important also is that as we look at ways to increase access and have students get more access to AP courses, we have to also talk to teachers about what resources do you need in order to support those students that may not have typically chosen to enroll in that class. So those are kind of the two big points that we're walking away with. And we've already started our work with the high schools, already met with Morro Bay staff, and the teachers there are understanding and looking forward to moving forward with that, and I know they're in good hands with Dr. Pruitt and his team. So any questions about AP data?
At this time, I'd like to go to the public, see if there's anyone here who would like to speak to this presentation, the data. Seeing none, we'll come back to the board, Mrs. Roger, then Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. Mrs. McGrath, on the last item there, we need to work with AP teachers about how to support students in AP classes with limited resources. What do you have any ideas, I guess, about what information teachers are going to give to you in terms of resources that they need Do you have any ideas about resources for them?
We've started that conversation, and some of it is looking at the same kind of support structures that we put in place for students that are struggling, right? Mm-hmm. So we put in support structures within a class and outside of a class for students that are for example, maybe struggling in math, right, in a typical math class. There's some similar kind of structures that are needed either within the classroom and outside of the classroom for a student where an AP class may be a bit of a challenge, right? So although we want to give more access, we're looking at how can a teacher within a class then support those students. So possibly it's additional writing help, right? So often the writing level expected within an AP class is very rigorous. And so how can a teacher work with individuals and small groups within their class to help support them? And then are there outside components? So are there other seminars? Are there outside study groups? Are there things where students could meet together with peers? And kind of starting to brainstorm with teachers, what are those supports that they're noticing? And what can we do as we provide access to make sure we're also providing the support they need to be successful?
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Buckman and Mr. Unger.
Hi, Kim. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Good. It's really nice to see all this improvement, and I'm really excited about the students that have transitioned. In this last slide, I think it's the third one down, we need to be more targeted about AP enrollments for capable students. If not now, at some time in the future, if you could just maybe what are some of the determining factors that will talk about, you know, mm-hmm. what does that look like? I mean, are we going to look at past students, or are we going to look towards the future? But also, it's my understanding that you have to pay to take the exams. Is that correct?
You do. There's two different payments. So the typical test takes $86 per test. However, you can also qualify for, depending on your socioeconomically disadvantaged status, you can also qualify, and then it's only $5 per test. So some of that tends to be complicated because some students choose not to take the test for a variety of reasons, right? So every university and every college within that university gets to determine if they're going to accept a test and even what score they're going to accept and then what they accept it to give credit for. So some students, are calculated about that and look forward to see if they know what university they're headed to and whether it would benefit them or not.
Okay, so it's my understanding that the state offers financial aid if the district asks for it, and I'm wondering whether our district does seek out the state's financial aid for students that are unable to afford the exams.
We do. So students are able to enroll and take the test for $5, and then we do turn in our paperwork in order to be reimbursed and typically get some portion of that reimbursed.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Unger, then Dr. Eisendrath Rogers.
Yes, Kim. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Mr. Richard. My question just has to do with the courses that are not being offered this year. And was that due to lack of enrollment or loss of the teacher who had taught that class?
I believe lack of enrollment. I think AP Art History, AP Latin, and then, like I said, Calculus BC will likely be an ongoing as just that it's would take a lot of extra years of math in order to reach that level. So classes do fluctuate depending on student interest, and sometimes if there's a very small interest, it doesn't justify running an entire course for it.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you.
You.
Thanks, Kim. I have a couple of questions. Does enrollment in an AP class, whether you pass the test or not, give you extra grade points toward graduation?
Yes.
And so, as well as the honors classes do that too, right?
Correct. So typically if you, in an AP class, if you receive a B, you would have one grade point bump, so you would have a 4.0 instead of a 3.0.
Okay. And then to be clear, these scores you're reporting don't relate to the quest to concurrent enrollment, right?
Correct. That is a different topic.
Yeah, and I'd love to hear more about that, too, because I guess a question, if I were a student, I'd be asking is, which is more valuable to me, Cuesta concurrent enrollment, where I'm getting college credits that I can pretty much transfer right away, but that may or may not go toward my grade point average at San Luis Coastal, or AP classes? I think that mm-hmm. would be an interesting thing. thing.
I think
you're
right.
It would also be interesting to find out which, if either one serves a student better or if they're equal in terms of what is, you know, what does a student get out of it, right?
Absolutely. I think there's pros and cons to both, for sure.
Okay. And then the other thing I'm kind of curious about is this calculus BC. I know that in different school districts, especially high school districts, there is this ongoing debate about traditional math versus integrated math. And so I'm assuming that the Calc BC is probably becoming less possible as you do integrated math. Is that true?
I think whether you chose a traditional or integrated pathway, the typical path when you got to high school would be either Algebra 1, Geometry, Algebra 2, pre-calculus. So your senior year, the typical traditional pathway would be to end at pre-calculus. If you're an integrated, it would typically be an integrated 1, 2, 3, and still end towards a pre-calculus. So even achieving a calculus AB would be a year beyond the typical sequence.
Okay. And then the BC is a more advanced class than that.
Even 2 years beyond, correct.
Okay. Just, I'm curious, does it leave, and I'm not being a math head, would have assumed I would have taken calculus, let alone pass it, does it leave our students at a disadvantage that there is this BC class out there and that there may be other students that it maybe a point of competition when for college enrollments? And does mm-hmm. that matter? I'm just kind of curious about that.
Right. The way I see it is that with Common Core standards that are national, it kind of put everyone in the same, you know, competition there, right? The typical student across the nation now will finish at pre-calculus. And it is a different way of thinking than what we were used to, where it was the typical student could end if they chose to take 4 years of math at calculus AB. So it doesn't put us at a disadvantage at all. And also the fact that we've put in multiple opportunities for acceleration, really at every grade level from sixth grade on, so that if a student has that desire to accelerate and to move on and they want that math challenge, they still would have the opportunity to get there, either through our accelerated courses in the middle school or by doubling up or by challenging a test or by doing summer work, etc. So if a student had that desire and wanted to continue to challenge themselves to that level, they could get there if they chose to do it. And everyone, I think that is the good part about Common Core, everyone kind of arrived in those same shoes. The other thing to keep in mind is when we were hearing from college professors, they often told us the race, you know, and the speed at which we were having students go through math was they didn't find very beneficial, because what they found is that students were arriving and able to complete the algorithm and crank through and get the answer, but they didn't truly have a deep understanding. And they found that to be kind of a harm to students as they got to a college level of math where they needed them to have a deep conceptual understanding. And so hopefully by adding that extra grade level before algebra in the eighth grade, this will help students to develop that deep conceptual understanding and actually understand and know what they're doing in math instead of just being able to only arrive at the answer.
Well, and that just brings to mind another question, because my understanding is that the, and again, never having taken an advanced placement class, that the credit for an advanced placement class is based on whether you pass the test at the end or not. And the test looks like the old test, not like the new Common Core test that we're giving. Is there any movement toward reforming the AP classes and the tests that the students are getting so that it looks more like what our expectations are rather than what we used to be doing?
Right, so two separate issues. So one is that you can complete the course and have credit for the course and decide to take or not take the test. So those are kind of two different. One is the course, one is the test, and two separate things. So I can complete my AP course, choose not to take the test, but still have credit for my AP class. Passing the test can help me with college, but it doesn't necessarily have an impact on my high school course. The second piece of that is that College Board, yes, fortunately, they are. College Board is in that same arena with AP and SAT, and they are actually part of looking at matching their expectations type of questions, level and depth of question to meet the expectations that students are seeing. So glad to see that actually SAT and AP are kind of are beginning to make that transition as well. You're welcome.
Anything else? Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks. Thank you.
All right. Next, item 9.02, approve property conveyance. Mr. Palazzo.
Good evening. Kim, if you wouldn't mind pulling up the photos, I think that tells the story better than I can even. So, what's in front of you tonight is an agreement for property conveyance of a portion of the property at our Morrow Elementary site out in Morrow Bay. A little bit of a history on it, and again, part of this is speculative based on some of the documents I've reviewed in our files, but it appears that when the original campus was built, that Napa Avenue went through from kind of where our parking lot is now between those two green lines, and either the city or some kind of a deed was given over to the city for access to use that as Napa Avenue, and it remained as district property. And as part of that road construction, a little sliver of property between that green line and that red line still remained district property. But as you can see, if you can go to the next picture, that may be actually two slides in, two pictures down, if you would. That sidewalk was constructed. And so I think, you know, back in the 40s or 50s when this happened, the adjacent property owner to the south just kind of assumed that the property line was there, built the fence, they put in some power poles. It just kind of became part of the adjacent property. So fast forward to earlier this year when the adjacent property owner began to make some major improvements on their property, underground plumbing, some paving, new restrooms, et cetera, really trying to increase the desirability of the trailer park there, was kind of shocked to discover that a small sliver of his park, or what he thought was his park, was actually district property. So contacted us. We started to investigate it, and sure enough, yeah, it looks like that little sliver was on district property. So my first concern personally was, oh my gosh, how much do we owe him for taking care of that little sliver for the last 60 years? But more importantly and more seriously is that, you know, there is a liability issue from the district from the standpoint of we don't actually have control of that property. And then two, if we did get it back, now we've got this very strange little sliver of property to take care of. So we contacted a legal attorney, you know, what do you do in these situations? And luckily, Ed Code has provisions when you have these strange property line, I'm not sure what the word is, but just these strange conditions where you have property lines that are very ambiguous, if you will, that the Ed Code allows districts to quick claim deeds of small slivers of property like this over to adjacent owners to kind of reconcile long-standing property line kind of confusion. So that being said, what we did is talk to the adjacent property owner and developed a plan that they would pay for all of the costs associated with making this property transfer, i.e. the legal fees, the lot line adjustment fees, any surveying, title reports, and escrow fees, and we would, as a district, be able to quit claim that little sliver of property over to them. You know, alternatives to that would be to go ahead and do all that work ourselves and then sell the property to the owner, which would probably, when you do it all, we'd probably spend more money than we would make on this little teeny piece of property. So it seems like that's a very fair and equitable solution to go ahead and move forward with that. So we worked with legal counsel to put together this agreement. The adjacent property owner is in conceptual agreement with this. I've been in contact with him the last few months. And so we're bringing forward this to the board this evening for discussion and hopeful approval so that we can move forward with opening escrow, applying for a lot line adjustment with the city, you know, making the adjustment on the legal property line of that, and then transferring the property over to the adjacent owner.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the public here to address this? And I would just clarify, Mr. Palazzo, that this never rose to the level of any sort of property dispute.
Oh,
this
no,
was
no,
just
not at
some,
all.
It ended up being some confusion, and
yes.
We, in seeking to clarify it in the interests of both parties involved, this is an equitable and expeditious way handling this.
Yeah, and the adjacent property owner has just been absolutely wonderful to work with, and he was more concerned about, you know, having, you know, the same kind of issue, like, oh my gosh, all of us discovered it, and he bought the property, you know, 20 years ago.
And he has borne some of the costs involved
he will bear all the costs in rectifying this.
Yeah. So, okay, thank you very much, Mr. Quesenberry.
And you didn't require of him any kind of notice in perpetuity about how reasonable and kind and generous we are, including, you know, sending us out to the various news outlets.
I will see what we can do in that regard.
I'll see
if that's actually something the legal recommends we put into the agreement.
Mrs. Roger.
Thank you. Just to be clear, Mr. Palazzo, I think we are, but just to be certain, no one involved in this process on the district side has been able to determine any potential beneficial use for this little sliver of property to us.
Yeah, Kim, if you go back to that picture right there. So if you look at this main, where that little arrow is that says proposed property line in yellow, that arrow there, if you can go down to the next picture, Kim, please. So that's about looking at that. So the area we're talking about is basically from that fence to about the back corner of that, well, probably just a little bit to the left of that palm tree there in front of you. So I tried to come up with some conceptual designs for a condo complex in there and just really couldn't really come up with something that would sort of fit in. So, tiny house.
I'm hearing some of my board members, perhaps a shuffleboard.
Were you working the skateboard ramp angle
one bowling lane?
Not sure CISC would really like us to have that on there. So anyway, you can see this property basically from the back of this fence, which is roughly where the new property line will probably go, depending on how where it works from the legal description, over to about where that palm tree is, just slightly to the left of that palm tree. That's the piece of property we're talking about.
So no beneficial use for us and a liability that
correct.
We would prefer not to
and
have.
And I don't have a lawnmower that fits on that side of a hill, so it makes it a little tough. If we did get it back, how do we mow it and take care of it?
This time, are you seeking board approval for this?
For the agreement that was attached.
Okay, then I would entertain a motion.
I'll move approval of, we're calling it the conveyance of a portion of the Morrow Elementary School site as described in the agreement between San Luis Coastal USD and Harborview RV Park LLC, and further authorize the superintendent or his designee to execute and record the necessary documents.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you very much.
Thank you very
Go
much.
Go forth and do a lot of paperwork.
And convey, right?
And convey. Thank you. Next, item 9.03, nomination to County Committee on School District Organizations.
Yes, for this item, I'm asking the board to consider a specific nominee for the District 2 membership for the San Luis Obispo County Committee on School District Organization. Mr. Alan Buentiempo is a parent who represents what I see as the Estero Bay community. He has children at both Morro Bay High School and Cayucas Elementary School. He resides in Cayucas. So it highlights the important perspective that I believe is missing from this particular committee. And it's our opportunity, with the current term expiring, held by Kathy Madonna, who lives in Cambria, this would be our board's opportunity to come together with the Cayucas School Board, who has already nominated Mr. Buentiempo. And I'm asking tonight for your nomination of him so that he may go before the SLO CSBA committee, which is made up of board members from each of the districts who will meet this month to actually appoint this particular District 2. And so your nomination tonight is very important, I believe, to us, especially as it represents our interests in the Estero Bay community.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the public here wishing to discuss this? All right, we'll come back to the board. Mr. Unger.
Well, and I also think it's important for us to be aware of, excuse me, that we do have a representative on the county committee currently from our school district, and that's Mr. Jones.
Any further discussion? Mr. Quisenberry.
Well, I'd just like to move the nomination of Mr. Buen Tiempo.
I'll second that.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Very good. Thank you. 9.04. Sit back and enjoy the discussion here. Measure D, Mr. Pinkerton.
All right. Well, the board, as well as staff and our school sites, everyone has spent much of the past year developing a plan for our expenditure of Measure D funds throughout our district. And so we focused on everything the board knows, from bond sales to project management to construction delivery models. We've run the gamut, right, in terms of all those things. We've also spent a significant time with both of our comprehensive school sites, both San Luis Obispo High School and Morro Bay High School, on really looking at the budget, setting project priorities, and coming up with a board-approved project priority list that was vetted with site constituents. So I'm happy to note that tonight we're ready to move forward with a significant portion of Measure D projects that coincide with those board-approved priorities. The projects and corresponding architect contracts we're asking the board to approve tonight will move forward under the design, bid, build, project delivery model. Mr. Holcomb and I have been working closely with our legal counsel, as well as the three architects that are part of the agreements tonight, to come up with a really solid base architecture contract that we will be able to hopefully use throughout a lot of our Measure D projects in the future. All of the projects we're asking the board to approve tonight come from that same base contract. So all of the contracts tonight that we'll be asking the board to vote on, it's that base contract throughout. The things that have changed, of course, are the project names, project construction cost, the architect firm, depending on which firm is doing that the particular work, as well as the architect fees, which in all cases are based on the construction amounts. Should these contracts move forward tonight, we'll be setting up individual meetings with each firm to complete the schedule, the meeting dates, some of the things that you might have seen as you went through the contracts that had TBD to be determined. And so we will be setting those up specifically. We have noted on the board agenda that is presented tonight, and Kim can show you at the top, that the current contracts that are currently posted have been updated with some. We had some grammatical errors, some crossouts that hadn't been deleted. We have put in the district's insurance amounts now are included in the contract. So some things, just really, grammatical types of things like that are now updated in the current contracts that we'll be asking the board to vote on tonight. Approving these contracts tonight begins the design phases of each of these projects. So it's good to understand that. So we'll begin the design, and of course, throughout the design process, both schematic and design documents, we will be coming back to the board, sharing what's happening, sharing the schematics. And before any designs move on to DSA, we'll be bringing them for the board for approval. So tonight, again, is just the architect beginning the process. The other thing for the board to understand is that the construction of each of these projects will vary immensely. So that's one of the things we'll be working on with the architects, is setting up that when will things get designed, when will they be phased in, when will the construction happen, because we're going to have to sit down with the site, with the principals, with the teachers, to make sure that whatever construction we do and how we phase that in, that it has the least educational impact at all of our school sites. So those are all things that will be considered, even if these projects move forward tonight with board approval. And so if it's okay with the board, what I would like to do is start with one school at a time. So begin with the Morro Bay High School architect contracts, review those with the board, the projects, those types of things, and then have the board move for approval, should the board want to, on those particular contracts. And then we will go to San Luis Obispo High School, move for approval for those particular contracts. And then lastly, the other Measure D, I hope my hope would be that that would be less confusing. We could look at the Morobe High School map, talk about it, talk about the projects there, get approval, then move on to SLO High School, talk about the projects, get approval, then the other sites, if that's okay. Okay?
I'd like to suggest that the board be able to just ask questions as we go.
Absolutely.
Rather than hold them till after number 17.
Sure.
Okay. Sure. And so, Mr. Unger, we'll start that process.
Well, the question I have is, will we be approving the contracts individually or as a group?
It's my understanding we're going to approve them as a group for
the architectural firm that's being recommended.
Yes,
for
correct.
The work.
That would be perfect.
Thank you.
Okay?
Yes, carry on.
So, Mrs. Holmes, if you'll pull up the Measure D website for me. And we'll start with Morobe High School. And then in terms of public input, Measure D website. Go up to projects. Morobe High School. If you go down a little bit, I just wanted to show the campus map. You can click on the campus, campus map, the very first square there, first picture. Okay, so the visual, I think, helps in terms of looking at this. So, again, one of the things that we looked at in terms of design, bid, build, in particular for the projects, were ones projects that definitely would fit that project delivery model. As we investigate other project delivery models that may take the rest of the campus on in terms of a total construction project. So these were some of the things that we thought about as we brought this recommendation to the board. So first of all, as the board knows, we already have moved forward on the pool at Morobe High School. So that is a project that is the first Measure D project out of the gate. It's actually in DSA right now. Hopefully we'll be coming out of DSA around February so that we can begin bidding construction on that project. So that's one thing that's already begun. We also started during that preliminary phase the schematic design for the Student Support Center at the front of the campus. So that schematic design has been established and is available right now. I think the board has looked at it at our Measure D study sessions. So the projects in front of you tonight for approval starts with the left side of the picture, and that is the J wing, which includes the automotive, which is the former transportation department. We found out that is actually a DSA approved building that we can actually gain square footage at Morobe High School for the school itself. And so that will become an automotive shop. We're going to have to put a classroom into that building as well in terms of some walls, those types of things. And then the J wing, which they've been working on at the site, which are this facility here, is basically going to kind of a CTE, art, ceramics, studio, some of our really high-end computer classes, those types of things, are all going to go in that J-wing building. So that really gets some classroom, restroom renovations happening. With that, currently the wrestling room is in this part of that building, and so that is going to be moving over into the gymnasium, the new gym, newer gym, I should call it. And so all of that work is one of the contracts that we have in front of you today. At the same time, we also, with this first set of projects, are looking at the design of the track and field, so synthetic track, as well as looking at both the bleachers on both sides in terms of modernization, renovation of those, how it fits into the project. Also going to be looking at the tennis courts at Morobe High School, resurfacing lights, new fencing, really cleaning up the section. So really kind of hitting this outside section of the campus in terms of the project for that. And at the same time, also looking at, with this pool, we know that there's going to be some community use. So in tying the community use in, we're going to need to look at securing our campus, both with the new project on this side as well as through the other parts of campus. And so one of the projects as well is to complete the design of our student support center, which is going to reorientate the entire front of the campus at Morro Bay High School. That is going to provide, of course, the safety features. Again, like we talked about, the community access, breaking that off from the rest of the campus. It's also going to provide valuable square footage because the current office building that's here is going to turn into classrooms. And so by moving the attendance, activities office, counselors, administrators, everybody out of that current building over, it's going to allow that space for us to go in later and turn that into to classroom space. So the great part about Morro Bay High School is we're not going to have to put a lot of temporary housing on this campus throughout the phases of construction. Real positive thing in terms of this campus. So those are the contracts with KBZ Architects that we're bringing forward tonight for approval.
Okay. I will defer to everyone else before I ask my questions. Mr. Buckman.
Just two quick questions.
Sure.
Ryan, when the sites did their list of what mm-hmm. they needed and then the board approved those, in my memory, I report that those were done in a priority order, that they had looked at their items in priority of what they saw as needed at their mm-hmm. campuses. So there was some discussion from the public and among the board members regarding the synthetic tracks and bringing mm-hmm. those up. And it's in my memory, and I could be wrong, that those fell pretty far to the bottom of what the sites were interested in.
So, I mean, true in terms of if you look at overall priorities and what we're going to do first. And so the problem with construction of those, even those top priorities versus phasing mm-hmm. and how you're able to get that accomplished aren't necessarily going to work hand in hand. And so I'm sure Mr. Holcomb can you know, address that as well in terms of his knowledge. But what we did do was we do have the board priority list, which included even the lower priority items.
Right.
So though moving forward with the design today, our, you know, basically we're focused on doing all of the things that the board had listed and that the site constituents had put forward as priority list.
Okay. So as a follow-up, it's just, again, it's my understanding that sometimes the prices and the cost to do things change. Mm-hmm. And if we had a set of priorities, are we sure we're not going to be ending up somewhere down the road where we now have really nice tracks, but we don't necessarily have classrooms that are fully equipped?
So,
could we spend the money?
Yeah. So what I would say to that is we have the bonding capacity of $177 million. So as we move forward, I believe the board, this is kind of what I've heard from the board, our two comprehensive high schools are our focus areas, that we want to ensure that we get all the projects completed at those two school sites. And so that, I think that's our focus in terms of our, as we bring forward recommendations to the board. So I don't see us doing a ton of other school sites, other projects, until we have a really firm grasp and handle on to ensure that we're doing everything and that we're going to be able to do all of the projects that the board has prioritized for the two comprehensive high schools. So that's one part of it. And then my second answer to that is we are going to have to ensure that every step of the way with these first projects that we're watching the scope, we're maintaining the budgets that we've set up for them, that we're doing our due diligence to ensure that what you just said doesn't happen.
Okay, so I'm just to review.
Absolutely.
It's staff's opinion right now that mm-hmm. if we get the tracks in place, we're not going to end up having to maybe not put furniture in a classroom because we've run out of money.
So
that's the belief.
Yes. And just because we begin the design for the track today, we may not actually physically construct that track for 3 years from now.
Okay, thanks.
But as the design of these moves forward and as we begin to phase and plan, I would suspect that within the next year we're going to have kind of a budget and plan in place to do all of the other construction on the campus so we can ensure that that doesn't happen.
Thank you. That's wonderful. Thanks.
Okay. Okay, and I do need to go to the public and make sure there's no one from the public on this particular item at this point. Okay, thank you. Mr. Unger.
Yeah, first of all, I really wanted to thank Mr. Holcomb for spending time with me yesterday and going through the different contracts with me and explaining the various nuances to them. So thank you very much, Ron. It really is helpful for this discussion. The second thing, I just want to kind of talk about what Mark is saying. Mm-hmm. I think what's my understanding from the conversations we've had is that this is going to be a very complicated project, and especially at San Luis Obispo High School because of the complexity in not only the construction but the programmatic aspects of it, making sure that students have classrooms and things like that. We may see construction in areas that don't on their face make sense. So in other words, we may start with something not necessarily because it was our number one priority, but because of all the needs of programmatically on the campus to get that piece done so that we can get this piece done so that we can make sure that our students are still being educated during the process. Is that my understanding?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
And we've been really focused on, I mean, if anything, these first projects were super tight, you know, budget-wise, focused on scope. The pools are a classic example, right, of not building Olympic-sized swimming pools to start and overspending on particular items. So we're going to have to do that with every single one of the projects that I pointed out tonight that we're moving forward for recommendation.
So I appreciate Chris bringing this up because on Morro Bay, you said that we're not going to have a lot of moving and modulars, but my sense has always been that at San Luis High we may. And so, again, so I'm sure we'll hear about that in a second.
Yes.
But so part of my concern is if I think you've already answered this, mm-hmm. but if we're out there doing tracks, that we may actually tie our own hands if we don't have a location to put the modules. Mm-hmm. But if I can summarize what I heard you say, is we're going to do the design work now, but we may not necessarily begin that work. So I'm satisfied, but I was worried also about tying our hands about where we would be putting modulars.
Okay, I have a couple of questions just about the contractual arrangements as a whole, not the specific pool. And I don't know whether I'm going to look to everybody for help with this. So a few things are, it's my understanding that we'll still have some tightening up to do. Those TBDs will be filled in.
Absolutely.
So when we approve things tonight, it will be subject to some minor, perhaps, revisions if any other grammatical or mathematical small errors are found or changes that need to be made or filling in those dates. But nothing will be open for renegotiation after tonight. Okay, so this is a clarification. So maybe minor corrections. And it's my understanding, but I just, again, want to be clear since we're approving things before every little piece has been done, that Dr. Prater will be the signatory to each contract. You will be signing the contracts. Okay. And I have a couple questions about process once these contracts are signed. I'm curious as to about who will be monitoring the costs as we go, and do we have a good, solid, tight process and procedure for every step of the way? Can you assure me about that, or Mr. Holcomb?
We could probably both touch base on that. Let me talk from my staff side. Mr. Holcomb probably can discuss the contract aspect of it, you know, a little bit probably in better specifics. So why don't we start there, and then I'll talk about staff and following up on the contract documents.
Well, the contract is set up so that the architects have to come back to us for any change in scope. We set the original budgets very, very conservatively to ensure that the architect strives to stay within that piece to fit in the overall budget. It is a measure of the commitment of the staff and the administration by starting on some of those projects which are lower down the list, saying we fully intend to do them all. And I'm of the opinion you have plenty of funding to do that. So in schematic design, the architects will return to us and say, here's what we have in mind. We have at our option on some of these to go back out for third-party cost estimating so that we ensure that what we're seeing on the paper literally fits within our budget. So there's a lot of checks and balances along the way. And then on the internal side, the administration of that contract will be set up with protocols that ensure that we don't stray from the boundary of the contract.
Okay.
It'll be very tight.
All right. And I want to know about bills coming in. Who will be approving for payment and matching and cross-matching bills as they come in?
So that's something we're, too. I think we're a team.
Right.
So Mr. Plaza, myself, Mr. Stewart, Mr. Holcomb, even Dr. Prater, as we've had these discussions moving through things. So from our staff standpoint, we're going to be completely tied in with the architect from day one. So from these initial meetings where we're setting up when we're going to meet, how we're going to meet, what we're going to talk about, laying out the timelines, the expectations for how they meet with staff, when they meet with staff, when they meet with us, we will have regularly scheduled weekly, every other week, where we talk about the progress of every single project that's going on and what's been done and what hasn't been done, those deliverables. And so at each phase of the contract, as you'll see as outlined, there is specific things that have to be done at those particular times. Now, we do have secretarial support for Measure D right now at BG&T, and so Kelly actually helps with keeping all the contracts together, those types of things. And Anthony actually is, Mr. Plaza is the one who really, again, sits with us, but goes through each of those steps, outlines what has to be accomplished, when it has to be accomplished, collects those deliverables. We'll be attending meetings with the architects at sites throughout the process. And that's going to help both with the scope question, it's going to help with the budget question, and also ensuring that all of the paperwork, all of the different steps are done prior to issuing any payment throughout each phase.
Okay, so there will be, I guess,
and
I don't
think I normally
I'm just,
approve.
They have to
come to me for the final approval at each phase.
And other
That's
people will
so
also be looking at things along the way.
Absolutely.
So if someone says, I would approve this, someone else may say, not so fast. I think this doesn't look quite right to me. Let's pull out and make sure. I mean, I'm sure as you can probably discern, I believe I'm speaking for my fellow trustees, take this fiduciary responsibility very, very seriously. We've been entrusted with these funds. It's crucial to us not just to be able to do to be able to do everything we promise to do and to do it well with as few hiccups along the way as possible. So my concerns lie in this carrying out the intent of the contracts and being able to look at our taxpayers with great confidence and say these projects will be done, the money's being spent wisely. People know how the money's being spent. Things are being checked. We're being very thorough throughout this process.
Sure.
So, Prater. I'm curious about, when I was looking at these contracts. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, when I was looking at these contracts to begin with, and noticed the cost amounts, that some of them were very exact. So, how are these costs derived from each architecture firm? Each organization putting forward contracts. How are those costs derived?
Well, the costs as we see them now are hypothetical, but they're grounded in other bids taking place around the state as best we could arrive at. However, the mechanism of the contract means that they'll be bringing it back. We'll be checking cost, resetting fees if necessary, but all of these numbers fit within our budget. Not within and there's been a lot of changes because the architects would look at something and say that's worth $6 million. We say, well, we only have $4 million, so it's got to fit within $4 million. But that's not artificially derived. That's based on what's taking place around the state in real numbers, in real time, adjusted as to August 15, so to speak. So hypothetical numbers made real, and then the architect has to live up to that challenge to fit what's occurring elsewhere in the state. So it's very controlled.
Okay. And there are firms that we will work with or decide, you know, there's different firms that will do cost estimating for us and can kind of break down. They know the market factors. They know what's happening, can give you those information so that you can, you know, again, and I think Anthony's kind of talked about this throughout the design phase, it's really easy early on to make scope changes. It's really difficult as the design goes on. So it's really critical that at that first schematic design phase that the board sees it, that we all know, that we have a good cost estimate at that time, and we make good decisions as we move forward. Tomorrow we're actually going to Santa Maria to see a couple of buildings that were recently completed and looking at the cost of those and the square footage cost to make some comparisons about our own facility. So, I mean, we're really going to have to do our own due diligence as well to ensure that those cost estimates are really in a valid place for us and that our architects can, you know, kind of work with and move forward with.
And again, that contract is set up. There's like three different places where they have to narrow the variation within their number. So it's a very precise mechanism that we have set in place, and I'm sure it'll perform for us.
Okay. And then I have one more question. Maybe this is premature, you know, getting ahead of us a little bit, but in reading about change orders, you know, we hear a lot about change orders and how problematic those may be. I'm curious about who will be the process and who will be approving change orders. I know this is a while, a ways off before we'll be dealing with those, but I'm anticipating that not every change order will be able to come before the board because some will be very timely. Maybe perhaps something can't wait till the next meeting. Is there going to be an approval process or change orders are approved? The board gives direction to approve change orders up to a certain dollar amount that can be done by staff or by Dr. Prater, but anything over that would come before the board. How did those kinds of things work?
So it's actually going to be quicker than you think, right? Because we have a pool at Morro Bay High School that's going to be going to bid very soon. So that we're going to have a pre-qualification, a bidding process going to come to the board for approval and kind of guide that. And then we'll also have construction contracts, which I would believe would outline all of the things that you're addressing today and really lay that out in terms of what the processes are going to be throughout construction. Anything to add, Mr. Holcomb?
Within our construction contracts, which we're beginning to work on now so that we're ready, again, there's a very precise mechanism. You know, before we actually see a change order, you begin to see the rumblings of the language in our project meetings. So we don't allow anybody but internal staff, and I'll be reading, I would imagine, every one of those or attending them, to start making noise that will end up in a change order. So we try to catch it very, very early. And, you know, because the district is paid to design plans. We paid a contractor to build them. In theory, there should never be a change order. In theory. And indeed, if it's skillfully done, the percentile should be very, very, very small. But we do have a process where we direct a change, knowing that it will turn into a change order. Let's say we dig up an oil tank or something absolutely not foreseeable. So we're not going to stop the project. It will move ahead. But it will come back to the board either in terms of even if you authorize a superintendent up to a certain percentile of change order, it still comes back to the board in an information item and in an open session. So.
Okay. And will those kinds of things be coming to us in terms of authorizing the superintendent to approve or someone to approve change orders up to because that seems like an action item to me, something that the board would need to a process the board would need to agree on?
Well, we'll have to check with legal counsel and see what the allowable number is. It has historically been 10%, but,
okay,
you know, on $200 million, that's a ton of money.
Right.
So we'll try to narrow that and give you another mechanism that you approve ahead of time so you know what's occurring.
Okay. But those contracts, I mean, those are things that I think through our study sessions come to the board for approval, you know, however much time we need to spend in discussing them, talking about them, we'll definitely, you know, need to, I think, get that up front to you now so that you know before February kind of what you're deciding on, what we're looking at.
Right. I just need a good enough overview tonight, knowing that we're going to be voting on this, that I'm comfortable with what's going to be
I was just going to add, I think it would be perhaps helpful for me at least, and I don't know about the rest of the board, if we could set up some general parameters on what, though, for example, the change order approvals would look like through all the contracts. at least at this point. For example, Mr. Holcomb mentioned 10%. Now, you know, at $4 million, that's $400,000. That's, you know, that's a significant amount of money for one person to approve a change order. So I would just suggest that perhaps at one of our study sessions or at some point we hear from the staff what would be reasonable and what then the board, I think, would be comfortable with giving staff authorization to approve, as opposed to having come to the board for each one. And I think setting up those sort of general parameters would be helpful, rather than having to do them individually for each contract, which I think is kind of what I heard you originally say. And I'm not sure we want to. It may be in the contracts, but I think it would be helpful when we're developing the contracts to just have that language done up front. Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, I'm done. Anyone else? Mrs. Roger.
Well, I've reviewed, I gave thorough review to one contract and then just looked at the balance, because I inquired of Mr. Holcomb and found out they're not all different. This is a template mm-hmm. contract that we're using, and so they were only different as to the firm, the scope, and the dollars. And the monies for additional services. So I feel, and I'm not an expert, but this contract has been vetted as to form by our attorneys, by Mr. Holcomb, by yourself, by Mr. Palazzo, and I feel comfortable in reading it. It seemed like a really tight contract to me that spelled just about everything out, and some of the things that Mrs. Sheffer's concerned about, the change orders and what have you, really are not things that we're contemplating in the letting of these contracts. Those would come further downstream with construction contracts. For changes for the architectural firms involved here, I think it was pretty clearly delineated in the contract that through the various stages of design, there would be contingency monies allowed of, I think it was 10%, 10%, 5, and then for final drawings, mm-hmm. zero. So that by the time we got to construction drawings, everything would be complete, tight, and without any contingency money allowed. So I feel really comfortable as I can be as a layperson with the structure of these contracts. And I'm prepared to go ahead and vote to approve tonight.
Are you making a motion?
For Morro Bay High School.
Right.
Does anyone else have comments? I'll move approval of the contracts for KBZ, the architectural firm. Can we just call them KBZ in the motion? As presented this evening, for the Module 1 projects at Morro Bay High School, tennis court renovation, synthetic track and bleacher renovation, CTE building modernization for the J-Wing, auto shop and wrestling room relocation, and student support, construction of student support center, as presented.
I'll second that.
Is there any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right, next.
Okay, San Luis Obispo High School. So, Kim, if you go back to the Measure D site, and if we go to slow high projects, a lot of it kind of mirrors some of the same projects that you'll see from Morro Bay High School, equity-wise, I believe, if we hit this.
So again, this is a much, much more difficult site when we looked at it in terms of phasing and what to do with classrooms. And because you, at Morro Bay High School, you have a site that's built for many more students than they currently have. So they have a lot of extra room, space, classrooms that they can, you know, hopefully be able to do as best they can to ensure kids have classrooms, teachers have classrooms throughout the construction project. At Slow High, not going to happen. So one of the first projects that we're looking at is putting some temporary housing on this campus, and specifically taking some of our older module classrooms in our district and bringing them over as temporary housing units at San Luis Obispo High School, specifically about 10. Now, those might be classrooms. We looked at potentially bringing a restroom module over. And then there's also the potential of using one of them as a kitchen serving area. As part of the construction process. So that lay down area is either going to be here along the road or potentially along the old gym. So that'll be something that we'll be working with the architects to study the best placement, because again, we could have sewer lines, we could have water lines, electric. So how that's going to fit best on the campus is something we're going to want to determine at that time. Mr. Quisenberry.
There's never been any infrastructure for modulars in those two places. Is that correct?
Not that we're aware of, right?
No.
Okay.
Good.
But it is really close in the access road to be able to go out and grab it. And then a lot of the electrical we can run overhead because of the temporary nature.
Okay. Thank you.
So really getting some housing on this campus is going to be critical, because one of the first phase projects is looking at the old gym, so clearing out the current boys' locker room. There's a classroom there, as well as the weight room on this side, so that we can do some renovations in that building. And then one of the things we looked at, too, in terms of the track and field, the pool complex, and tennis courts that are in front, is we really wanted to look at this entire space as we did our design. One of the things we found from our planning is that there's some potential sewer lines and things. And so by looking at the entire site, getting the design done, it's going to really help us in terms of that phasing and doing it properly and making sure that we don't run into issues one after another on that side of campus. Again, in terms of project layout, you know, the tennis courts over the counter a little faster, easier to do, and some of the other projects will take more time as we go through. Because of the pool complex that's in front of you tonight, we will have to do some renovations to the current locker room. There's actually a lot of unused space in the current, the newer gym, I should say. And so moving that locker room space over, making sure that we have equity on both the boys and girls side, and reorienting the team rooms and things will definitely be something that we'll want to do, as well as we need a new HVAC unit for this facility to get some air flowing through that building. And so the other thing that's part of the project is an HVAC for the music building. Currently does not have one, and so that's something is one of our initial projects to get going. And then the last one was really we looked at the annex building, which is a current cafeteria, a little multi-purpose room, and a few classrooms. In going into that building and really doing some due diligence of looking in the walls and seeing what's there, we realized that this is it's a reinforced masonry building, but it was reinforced in the 60s. And so it's really cost prohibitive for us to go in and modernize that current structure and turn it into classrooms. So the thought now is basically to move forward with putting a new classroom structure in that place, classrooms and restrooms. And so the positive thing about that in general as well is right now we were looking at turning that into about 8 classrooms. And at San Luis Obispo High School, as you can look on the map, there's really no real estate to expand ever on this campus. And so by turning that project from an 8 classroom to a 12 classroom building, it's really going to add some future needed classroom space at Slo High. And both the temp housing and the annex are going to be super instrumental, as well as the student support center here in the front of the school. As Dr. Prater has talked numerous times about, perimeter safety of this campus ties in. It also provides a performance space theater on the back of the Student Support Center. And so that building, with those offices, activities, attendance, counselors, as well as temp housing, as well as the annex, are going to allow us to take major chunks of this building, which is really going to help us both in time with construction and overall cost. So by getting those accomplished, it's going to help the design and future construction of the main, you know, campus cafeteria building. We're going to be looking at all facilities, I think, even up here at the district office facility, that we can use to assist San Luis Obispo High School as well through this construction process. So those are all things kind of going through our thoughts as we're going to sit down with the architects and plan and phase and try to figure out how we're going to get this accomplished with the least amount of educational impact as possible. So those are the projects that we have tonight for the board that we brought forward for approval as design, bid, build projects.
Anyone from the public wishing to address this? Thank you. Dr. Eisendrath Rogers and Mr. Buckman.
I'm glad you mentioned relocating some classrooms up here, perhaps, or at Taylor Gym, because when I think about the portables and where we think about putting them, I'm wondering about teaching and learning in the midst of all of that construction going on around you. What do we know about how much noise abatement is available to us to prevent that problem?
So, I can't promise you that it's not. I mean, it's going to be tough, right? When you're and I lived through it at Roy Graney High School. I lived through it through 5-6 years worth of construction as we went through the process. But you can do it. You know, we'll get through it. We try to make the least impact as possible. I think the more we can do major demolition, things that are going to cause major issues like that over the summertime, I think is critical for us to do, and those are things that we're already looking at, in particular for the annex building, potentially. And so we'll just have to do whatever we can to work with the site, work with the teachers, work with the principals to limit those types of things. But there's no easy answer to that question.
So I assume we'll do some kind of, testing about if we put the portables behind the old gym, meaning like closer to that softball field, or along the main access road.
Yes.
But we'll test that out before we.
Oh, preferably this is the best location.
Is that you're pointing behind?
Pointing behind,
yes,
on the side,
yes,
there.
Yes.
That would be ideal, I think, if we can do that. Mm-hmm. Because, again, as you can see, there's a limited field space throughout this entire campus. So losing that, even that little field space, is critical. So we'll do everything we can, you know, to make sure that we address those types of issues throughout every single phase of the project.
And so on the annex building, just a question for
sure.
Mr. Holcomb also, because previously you'd advised us to use the design build, bid build with new projects. But then you make a point here that while this was going to be a modernization on annex, now that it's not going to be a new build, we can go with the more like the design bid build.
You know, a new project is easy to quantify, mm-hmm. so it's much safer. I would prefer design build, but we don't have time to get that in place before we have need for facilities. So design bid build, I think we've chosen the most logical projects in terms of cost control, in terms of campus impact, in terms of safety. You know, we're answering some safety questions that we trust will never be asked. And so I'm very pro of getting that campus secured. All of these projects we're talking about doing design, bid, build, we can fence out of the campus activity. So it's probably as best a plan that I think you could come up with.
It has your blessing.
And I do believe your annex building with 12 classrooms will probably end up equal to or less than the cost of modernizing that old building. You know, we went to investigate looking for termites and dry rot, and we found bricks. So it was quite a shock, you know. But So... it's the right move in terms of safety and cost and future capacity. I think it'll prove to be a very prescient look at your future needs.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one question, or maybe two questions dawned on me as we're going through this a little late in the game. During construction, generally there's a staging area. So the contractors keep all their equipment and the trucks and deliveries, mm-hmm. and I've never really asked or seen what our plans are at both of the high schools for staging areas. So when on San Luis High, is there a staging area outlined, and is it going to further impact the educational process?
Well, that's a question that we haven't answered yet completely. I mean, there is no ideal staging area.
Okay. I have a small backyard.
Right.
So there are some decent spots on campus, I will say. So there's a large section up here behind the campus that has potential for storing items and things. There's some slant, but there actually is some flat ground that's okay. above in that area. You know, like with the annex, they're going to take up part of the other area that's close to the annex as part of their staging area. So throughout each of these projects, and Ron could probably attest to it, next to the project itself, there will be staging area that is tied into that particular project. We actually just had Decal on campus. They were doing the summer work along the road there, and they were actually staging out here near the track as well. So we'll be utilizing any and every available square inch of that campus to assist.
And certainly one of our recommendations about design build will be to address that.
Okay.
Because we'll only have, in theory, then one set of contractors,
right,
as opposed to multiple contractors, which will make that much easier.
Okay.
But it will be a challenge, but I think we can answer.
All right. And so then this is probably not even doable. The thought occurs to me now as we're changing the annex. We're talking about having very little room on this campus. We already have a two-story building on this campus. So my question is, if we were to ask for the design of the annex to be the framing and the foundation to support a second story, would there be any value in that, and would it be cost prohibitive?
Really long answer is no, and the short answer is no.
Thank you. But in my dreams, it was yes.
So just to be clear, because that was a question I had similar to yours, Mark, mm-hmm. staging area is equivalent to construction trailers, that sort of thing, because that was a question I had for not just storing equipment, but typically the construction companies have their own mm-hmm. mobile offices
sure.
on site. So
depending on the size of the project, yeah.
Are those different things? Is that different from a staging area? Because I had written down where will construction trailers be at San Luis High, that's going to be one more.
They'd happen in the same general area.
Okay.
So, but the projects we've chosen, again, are kind of on the periphery of the campus, which makes that a much easier equation.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, just San Luis High is so tight already. Marilyn.
I want to make sure I understood what Mark just said. Were you saying, would it be cost prohibitive to engineer the new annex building now to take the loading of a second story downstream?
Yes.
And was Mr. Holcomb's answer, no, it would not be cost prohibitive?
It would be.
Things change so rapidly on code and regulation that whatever you anticipate today is wrong in 10 years almost always. So, and the money you plow into the ground waiting, you'll probably never recover. You probably wouldn't choose that place. There's so many changes can take place, it's rarely a good idea.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe in downtown LA, but not here.
Okay, thank you.
It's a good question.
Anything else from the board before we seek a motion to, are you ready for a motion
sure,
to approve?
Absolutely.
All right. Catherine.
I will move acceptance of, let me make sure we're on here. I'm on here.
Kim can highlight the exact wording
thank you,
for
Kim.
You.
B. I will move approval of this motion to approve the architectural agreements. Whoops. With PMSM, if I can read that far, architects for Module 1 projects at SLO High School, which include the pool complex, the locker room renovation, the tennis court renovation, the synthetic track and bleacher renovation, new annex classroom building, old gym renovation, music room, HVAC, temporary housing and student support center building and performing arts space.
Is there a second?
Yes.
I'll second it.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Two down, one to go.
Okay.
Good work.
So the next group of architect contracts is for RRM. And so I'm going to go ahead and just do these kind of together as one group, you know, not specific with the high school. So we'll start with Bellevue Santa Fe because it ties right into San Luis Obispo High School. So one of the cost-cutting measures that we thought of doing just to begin with is let's take the modular classrooms that are currently older at Bellevue Santa Fe and use those as our temporary housing at SLO High, thus giving new classrooms to Bellevue Santa Fe and doing some restroom renovations on that campus. So that is one of the architect contracts that's coming to you today. So that's one. The second and third goes to Bishop's Peak, and then there's two more for C.L. Smith. And the purpose and the reason why Bishop's Peak and C.L. Smith are coming forward today is because those are two schools that did not get the renovations that all of the other schools got under Measure A. And so this is kind of bringing them equity, bringing them up to the same status as our other campuses. That includes at Bishop's Peak a new multi-purpose room, which, of course, like all of our other multi-purpose rooms, I believe, throughout the district, has a music room and a cafeteria as part of it and some storage facilities. So that would be the one contract. And then the second Bishop's Peak would be then moving the office to the current multi-use space and turning that space into the office. So those are the two plans at Bishop's Peak campus. We're also, during that process, we want to do a traffic study, talk to the city about the potential of what can we potentially do, and I don't know if we can or not, to redirect traffic, to potentially come around, go straight up the hill where now it's only an out and people have to drive through the neighborhood. If there's a way that we can redesign that where people could come around, maybe have a roundabout at the other end to come through, something like that, is something that we've talked to RM about, at least studying that. I think we should look at it as we do these renovations and see if there's something we can do to really save those homeowners that have the major traffic that goes right through their street every single day. So that'll be part of those two particular projects. Then at C.L. Smith, their TK kindergarten preschool program has expanded there. They need a new modular with a restroom inside. And so one of the contracts is to put a modular there. We'll be taking that modular and bringing it over to SLO High School to help with our temp housing. And then the second contract for C.L. Smith is to expand their current office building, so bringing it up to par with all of the other campuses as well. And so those are the five contracts that are in front of the board tonight for RRM.
Anyone from the public wishing to speak to this? All right, back to the board. Any questions on this final set of contracts with RRM? Seeing none, we'll have a motion, please.
I'll move approval of the architectural agreement with RRM Design Group for Module 1 projects at various sites, Bishop's Peak office multipurpose room and parking security improvements, C.L. Smith office modular classroom and security improvements, and Bellevue Santa Fe Charter School modular classrooms and restroom renovation.
I'll second that.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Thank
as
you.
Crazy as it may seem, we're really excited.
I think we're
we
all...
We are really... The staff is really excited to move forward.
We're all very excited.
And show the public what their investment is going to bring to them. So we're gung-ho to get going. So thank you very much.
Get to work. All right. Next... Measure D, authorizing pool of project inspection consulting services.
Mr. Okay,
Watson.
Good evening. Back again. So as you know, we are going to start embarking on construction. Measure D is not all about PowerPoint presentations. It actually ultimately is about construction. And one of those things, one of the requirements by the DSA and by the California Building Code is that the district hire an inspector to be on site at all times on every project that we have going on that's approved under the DSA, and any projects that are potentially exempt also may require inspection by an inspector. So the district embarked on an RFQ that went out, RFQ number 257, that we had reviewed earlier with the board prior to issuance. We received, I believe, seven responses to that RFQ. One respondent was actually disqualified for contact with other staff members, which was specifically prohibited in the RFQ documents. And the selection committee screened the applicants preliminarily and came up with these six firms that were qualified, local firms that were available for a pool of inspectors to be on our construction projects as we start to move forward. Now, the idea was not to get into a very long, in-depth interview process at this stage because as projects start to come up, they may or may not be available. I mean, these are independent contractors in many cases, and so they take the work as it comes. And so we wanted to get a nice pool of them so that as some work starts to come up, hopefully several of them are available. We can then do more in-depth interviews at that time, finding out a little bit more about their individual qualifications or experiences with projects of like kind that we're going to be having coming forward, and then work with those folks in that capacity. Simultaneously, we'll be starting to work on a contract template for these folks as well that we'll have throughout the Measure D program. So with that, we're bringing forward tonight approval for the pool of these six firms to be in our Measure D pool of inspectors. It's not to say that in 6 months we call them and they're all unavailable. We may have to go back out or, you know, that we might be coming back in another year for another pool. You may see this happen a little bit more, but we wanted a very transparent process in making this first selection and getting our pool put together so we could begin, not have any delays, not try to do this, you know, a week before we're starting construction. Let's do it now. Let's be ready so we have everything ready to go. And this is one less thing we have to do as we're trying to get shovels in the ground. So,
anyone from the public here to address this? All right, back to the board. Any questions, Mr. Buckman?
Before I make the motion to approve this, I'd like to admit that I was reading the agenda very quickly, and I read this, authorized pool project inspection consulting services, and I was trying to figure out why we needed like eight guys to inspect the pool at Morro Bay. But then on reading it again, I think I got it. So I'd like to make a motion to approve the consulting services that were that responded to the RFQ.
I'll second that.
Mrs. Rogers?
I just had a question. That's okay. Pardon me. When you say that we're required to have a DSA-approved inspector or a DSA inspector on every job, if we've broken projects into, if we've phased things or for our purposes we've separated things, but they are all occurring on one site, like Morro Bay High School or San Luis Obispo High School, can you just have one inspector on the site?
Yeah, it'll really depend on the actual scope of the certain projects that we're taking on. For example, if it's two smaller projects, like the J-Wing and the tennis courts at Morro Bay High, just for example, we can definitely have one inspector working on those two projects. We'd work with the local DSA field engineer to assess the full scope and making sure that we're not overloading the inspector. But if, like at San Luis High, say we had the pool, building 100, and the annex going all at the same time, that's probably not going to lend itself to one inspector for those three. So we'll have to work with the local field engineer from DSA, who will be kind of working with us to assess that. But the goal would be to have sort of one inspector that does work, the bulk of the work at, say, each of the high schools, so that there is some continuity and that as they're putting a pipe in the ground over here and then we come to dig near that pipe again 6 months later, they kind of know where it is. That would be the goal.
Is there a minimum dollar amount for the value of construction or a minimum scope beyond which you have to have an inspector, which is to say, will we need one on the multipurpose room at Bishop's Peak? Also, we'll need a separate one on the office at C.L. Smith because one person can't be everywhere. Would we even need one at Bellevue?
We'll probably have one at each of those sites. And again, it's working with the local field engineer. Somebody doing Bellevue, there's not, say, inspectable work going on maybe all the time. And so sometimes they'll allow an inspector to have, say, a relocatable modular classroom project and another project. Okay. It just depends on the actual scope of those projects. But again, most of these folks work on an hourly basis. So we try to assess our contracts with an hourly cap on them, and then, you know, they work to those hours on that specific project. So, you know, if it's one person doing those hours on two projects or two people doing those same amount of hours on two projects, our cost isn't going to vary too greatly.
Okay. I'm just thinking that it looks like this list of this select bid list, I guess I would call it, looks like it has several individuals.
As far as I know, five of the six are independent contractors that are sole proprietor individuals.
So do we have a backup list of DSA-approved inspectors of significant length so that if we can get enough?
Yeah, we know where they are.
We can find them?
They're on the DSA's website, so we can find them.
Okay. Do we already have a second for?
Yes.
Okay.
I have a quick question. Who was on the screening selection committee? What is that committee?
It was myself, Steve Stewart, and Kelly Lee in our office were in the preliminary screening, as well as Karen Campbell-Bright from purchasing.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We have a motion. We have a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving on to the action consent agenda, please let me know if anyone wants an item pulled. 10.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 10.02, acceptance of donations. 10.03, approval of furniture and equipment requests. 10.04, approval of purchase orders. 10.05, approval of warrants and payroll. Mrs. Rogers.
I'll move approval of items 10.01 through 10.05.
I'll second that.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right. Anything, moving on, anything on the advanced agenda? Reports by board members. Mr. Pleasantberg, did you? That's what we're asking for.
I thought that's what I heard. Yeah, I won't take more than half an hour with this one. So, okay. Just wanted to mention that I was at Morro Bay High School last week and on another matter, but I got a chance to talk to Chris Jones, the assistant principal there. Always a pleasure talking to Mr. Jones. And he insisted that I go down to the library and meet with some Cal Poly tutors who were working with students there. And it was really a pleasure to meet these young women. I think it's a great thing when Cal Poly students come out to Morro Bay. That's not the most convenient place for them to go to. And they were there. And all of them were bilingual. And they were helping students in things like math and English and so forth. So I think that's a great development. I hope it continues. I hope we continue to encourage those students to work with Cal Poly students to work with our students. I also wanted to take a moment to recognize that Rotary has made some donations from our Grandparents' Day, which was held September the 13th. And Mr. Robinette might confirm these things or just correct them. We made a donation of $250 to the Music Boosters, which would go to out the coast there, so it'll be probably Los Osos Middle School and Morro Bay High School. Baywood Elementary was also $250, I believe. $200. And then the Morro Bay Choir for their trip, was it $500? $250. See, I wasn't at that meeting.
Spending the Rotary's money.
I might have been far more generous, but no. So again, that's $200 to Baywood Elementary, $250 to the Music Boosters, and $250 to the Morro Bay Choir. Oh, and one last point. I'm still under half an hour. I have an opportunity every Thursday to pick up my grandson at the Parent Participation Preschool, and it is so much fun, and it is so such a joyful place, and all those kids. We even have some of those 3.5, 4-year-olds who cry when they have to go home. Pretty impressive. Yeah, that wraps it up. Thank you.
Chris?
Yeah, I was able to visit Del Mar, and again, going into some of the classrooms, it's pretty amazing to see the teaching and the learning that's going on there. For example, one of the classes in their writing assignment, the teacher, and I believe it was a second grade class, the teacher had brought a rock to class. In fact, it was a second grade class, and what they had just completed was descriptions. A writing description of the rock, right? But then what they were doing was the next day they were going to actually write a story about the rock. And the teacher was explaining to them about pet rocks so that they could go from a descriptive written piece to more creative writing about the same thing. And I thought, this is great. This is great stuff because we're weaving our writing into our science. It was so neat. And then, again, just seeing teachers teach math with a group of students surrounding a teacher who's sitting on the carpet and going through different ways of getting at answers, it's pretty mind-blowing. And I was also able to get into the level literacy class, too, and really see the individual work that the teachers are doing with the kids. We're just doing some great stuff out there and should be recognized.
Catherine.
And Dr. Prater and Ms. Holmes and Mr. Unger and I were able to attend the first ever, it was an award ceremony at which one of our students from Slo High. Oh, excuse me, I'm so sorry.
And Ellen Sheffer, of course. Excuse me. Sorry, Ellen. So it was an honor, a ceremony for Leah Meyer was the recipient of the Young Humanitarian Award. This was the first time this has been done. And it was for her color run that she organized 2 years ago for the first time in honor of her brother, Alex Meyer, and which has raised funds for 60 college scholarships thus far. And so she's much deserved.
And I'll add that I attended a boardwalk at Los Osos Middle School with Andre Illig, and it was just wonderful to see the enthusiasm of the kids, and the enthusiasm of the principal was unbounded. He was practically leaping through the hallways. He was hard to keep up with. There was so much to see. It was so exciting. It ain't my middle school. How it was when I was there. We went into a classroom and saw where kids were creating and programming and coding robotic devices that will need to pick up a ball and launch it at something that was just amazing. I mean, these things weren't... When we talk about preparing our students for jobs that don't exist at this time... This was a prime example of, these objects and these opportunities and this kind of work certainly did not exist when I was that age. And to see this occurring now and how they will be able to project what they're learning into being able to fulfill some of these new unimagined careers is remarkable indeed, and the ease with which they do it, that they have absorbed this information and are able to apply it, is really encouraging and wonderful and hard for me to figure out. But it was really wonderful to see, and to see the classrooms were more things I could understand were being taught, were English and plays and teachers I've known for years and lots of new faces, and just to see the unbridled enthusiasm of the students and the instructors was really fun. It's why I do this. So thank you to Andre. And with that, we will adjourn until November 13th when we have a Measure D study session at 9 a.m. in B3 here at the district office. And then our next regular meeting on November 17th at Del Mar Elementary School in Morro Bay. So thank you very much and good night.